I noticed the Snap Store front end, that is snapcraft.io, hasn't been updated for a while, and it kind of annoyed me. So I started making something a bit similar to that, but my own version of it.
Has snapcraft.io not been updated since we used to work on snapcraft.io?
Maybe. And there are still some promoted applications from a long time ago, and it's a little bit sad. The reason I'm doing this is partly because I've noticed that the presentation of applications on the front end of Snapcraft.io is a bit sad and dated. It could be that there is data that says nobody goes there anyway, so who cares? I don't know. But I go there sometimes, and I think it would be nice to be able to see what snaps are new, which ones have been updated, and have publisher pages that maybe are a little bit more vibrant, have some more information in them, and are not just limited to like the very basic data that's in there. And recently I made this thing called Snapscope, you may recall. We've talked about it a little while ago.
It was the talk of the internet.
It was a little bit of a talk of the internet. And it does still pop up. I got a notification about it yesterday, I think, because someone mentioned it on Reddit in a completely unrelated topic, a web apps topic or something. Anyway, it still pops up now and then. It still runs. It's running pretty well, as far as I can tell. But one of the things it does is uses the Snapcraft API to go and find out what snaps are new and updated, so it can feed those into the machinery that does the vulnerability analysis. Now, I wanted something that was a bit more lightweight than that, that doesn't do all the vulnerability scanning and all that kind of stuff. I just want something that presents on a web page what's new, what's been updated, so you can have a look and see how vibrant is this thing, and maybe also show some, not necessarily leaderboards, but like, here are the 10 things that have been updated today. Here are the things that haven't been updated for a while. You know, those kind of things. Nothing vulnerability related, but just, this is new, this is old, that kind of thing.
So I do find these sorts of things really useful. And I know this was something that we were surprised to learn when we did work on Snapcraft, and all jokes aside, we learned that people actually used to browse the desktop app and use it as a means of app discovery. And although I don't use the Snapcraft store for that now, I did for a while because it was a place where you could find out what new software had turned up. But when I'm looking for new desktop applications, I do go looking in FlatHub, for example, and each time there is a NixOS release, I do go through the changelog because the significant new applications are listed in there, and I make a little note of like, oh, this is new and exciting, I might want to use that.
When you say like browsing for new applications, do you mean like not someone who thinks, I want a tool to do this, I'm going to go find one, but just seeing what's there and installing stuff and trying it out?
Well, it's hard to know what the motivation is because I can't get inside the head of the people who are browsing around the web page.
All right, fair point.
But I think it is fair to say, and we know this because, as Martin said, when we worked on the team, there are things we would do like promote certain applications or put them in a group called Editor's Picks, which pushed them to the top of the web page.
Yeah.
They didn't force them onto people's machines, but they pushed them to the top of the web page. But also, the same API was used by GNOME Software, Snap Store, whatever you want to call it, the graphical front end, and that pushed them to the top of that as well. And what we found was interesting was if we chose an application or a set of applications and put them in the editor's picks section along the top, the number of downloads of those applications would go up quite a bit.
Yeah.
And the only rationale for that is that people are looking in GNOME software, or they're looking at Snapcraft.io, or maybe, and this is a bit tenuous, they're doing snap find on the command line because that shows you the editor's picks by default. Now, that's all like super interesting, and I no longer work there and I have no control over the editor's picks. But it's sometimes still nice to see things that are new, like Martin said, like just a view of what are the types of applications that I've not heard of, or what is there that maybe I'm installing via some convoluted method. Maybe I'm building something from source and actually someone's already packaged it up and I don't need to worry about it. And so I could switch from, you know, building from source or an outdated deb to a snap.
Yeah.
And like Martin said, similarly, FlatHub has a web front end, which is a little bit more vibrant than the Snapcraft one, but there are way fewer packages in FlatHub. Don't at me. I've got the numbers. The numbers don't lie. So because I'm aware of the Snapcraft API and how it works, I thought I'd mock something together. And the other reason why I did this is because when I'm testing out the various tools that we have at work, the developer tools for AI stuff, sometimes I have to come up with an idea for something to code, not because I really want that thing to exist necessarily, but because I'm trying to think outside the box and try to push at the boundaries of what these tools are doing and see if they can do it and see if they do what I'm expecting them to. And so we're often like coding these silly things just to test the tools that we're building rather than building the same thing over and over again. It doesn't do you any favors to sit in your lane and build Tetris 10 times in a row. It makes more sense to try different things, try different frameworks, try different methodologies, different tools, and all that kind of stuff. So that's the other ulterior motive for creating this thing, was to test our software at work. Anyway, I built this thing. It shows what's new in the store. Packages have been updated. It gets the metadata, which is more than Snapcraft.io shows you, like which core it's built on. Now, for normal people, that doesn't really matter. But yeah, it might be interesting to some people who want to see, oh, is that built against this core or that core? Maybe I'll put in there extra information about which architectures it's available for. And, you know, so if I'm browsing on a desktop, can I tell whether this thing will install on my Raspberry Pi or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of information. The other thing I wanted to do was, I'm getting really happy with deploying things to Cloudflare. I know some people prefer putting their web apps in Vercel. Other people just run it off, you know, VPS or chuck it in Docker. See last episode about my opinions of Docker. I wanted to have something that I could deploy to Cloudflare. And because this thing's going to poke the Snapcraft API on a regular basis to get the updates, and it varies wildly. Like one day there could be almost no updates at all. And then another day, every few minutes, something gets updated, especially if there's been like a holiday and people come back to work from holiday and are like, oh no, I need to address all these security issues or something. And then you get a whole slew of new snaps in the store. Whereas over Christmas and Easter, there's always a dip.
Mm-hmm.
Christmas, Easter, and summer holidays is a dip in updates everywhere to everything. And so there's like various times and peaks and troughs. And so it's nice that I can present this stuff. Now, right now, it looks like a bit of a bag of spanners. It doesn't look great, and it needs a bit of like visual zhuzh.
Mm-hmm.
But
panache, is the word you're looking for.
Oh, yes, panache, sorry. The other thing I want to do is make the RSS feed usable, because there's no RSS feed for what snaps are out there. I know some people think RSS is dead, but it's quite useful in terms of being able to turn that into some other presentation. If you've got an RSS feed, someone else could present it even better. So that's partly why the RSS is there as well.
And have you considered adding Alan's picks to see if that has an impact on installs?
I had not thought of that, but I think I would call it Popey's picks.
You do like alliteration, don't you?
I do. And if someone puts a snap in the store called Nose, then it'd be great. I can just have Pokey's Picks Nose this week. It would be great at the top of the web page. I like that.
Surely Bum.
Yeah, that as well. Yeah, all of these things. I love all of this. It would have to be posterior, though, Martin, for the alliteration alone. Yeah, so that's it. It's going to be published again, just on a subdomain. At the moment, it's just running off my laptop because I noodled with it to test some stuff out. But yeah, that's the idea. I'll make it completely open source. I'll just chuck it in a repo on GitHub and have it deploy whenever it updates. It has a SQLite database to keep track of this stuff. which I might regret and have to put it in something else, but I'll figure that out as time goes on. I'm just going to chuck it out there and feedback welcome, you know, pull requests, issues, all that kind of stuff.
So open source works.
Yeah. And if someone could do a better panache design, then I would appreciate that.
All the way back in episode 3, I talked about Cider, which is an Apple Music desktop client that runs on Linux and macOS and Windows. And I talked about how I had started using that in order to can my Spotify subscription and use Apple Music, which was part of our family plan when we all started using iPhones. Well, I'm here to tell you that Cider is dead for me. And I know we like to focus on the positive, but over the years I've been using Cider, it has kind of collapsed under the weight of features that have been added to Cider, to the point where it hasn't been offering the basic experience that I want, which is I want to listen to music and I want to listen to music reliably.
I remember this happening to another music player in days of yore called Amarok.
Really?
It used to be, I remember the KDE3 version was lovely and, you know, browse your library and hook into other sources. And then the KDE4 version came along and it was just like, features! So many features!
Do you know the one music player that this never happened to was Banshee? It had the perfect amount of features and then everyone flipped out about it being based on mono C#. And it just got banned everywhere and cancelled. And so you can't basically install it anywhere now because it's all out of date and it doesn't work. And it's a shame. But that I think Banshee is peak audio player for me.
There was a lot of good mono applications back then. They had a lot of energy and innovation around them. And some of the best desktop applications we had, even for a very short moment, it was kind of sad.
Lots of good games as well.
Yeah. But yeah, what I've found is that Cider has kind of just had this massive influx of features and some of the basics of the application just haven't been fixed and kept up to date. And I kept on finding my audio cutting out, me being de-authed from Apple Music, the volumes changing wildly between tracks, a whole bunch of issues. And I was like, how hard can it be to write an Apple Music desktop client that doesn't do any of those bad things and just gives me access to my music, maintains the audio quality, and works on Linux with like MPRI integration. And MPRI, for if you've not heard that term before, this is the way that audio applications on Linux allow you a standard interface for changing the volume, skipping to the next track, pausing music, displaying cover art, and all sorts of features like that. So that's what I've done. I decided I'd had enough of Cider and I have created Sidra, which is an elegant Apple Music desktop client for Linux and, in no small surprise to myself, for macOS and Windows as well.
Is that because you wrote it in mono?
Nice.
Good callback. No, I did end up writing it in something that I haven't used in 7 years. My initial idea was I would write this with a Go backend and a technology called Wales. And Wales is a web view front end that you can implement in TypeScript, and you can use things like React and Vue or Svelte for a web-like UI, but have it bound to a Go backend. And Alan and I have both been experimenting with this over the last couple of months, and it's pretty great. However, Apple Music is not like other streaming music services or most streaming music services in that it's got that DRM stuff in it.
Ah.
So I couldn't use that because there's no, you may have heard the term Widevine DRM, which is the component in Chrome and Chromium browsers, and Firefox uses it and the other browsers as a means to access DRM protected content. So if you want to watch something on Netflix or Disney Plus or Apple Music, you need this component available in order to do the content decryption. So I ended up using Electron, or rather a very specific version of Electron. And I haven't written or done anything in Electron since 2019. So this was a little sort of way back when Martin used to do Electron Journey. Now, the way it works is it basically takes music.apple.com and wraps it in an Electron tool. And that bit's easy. I had that bit working in 5 or 10 minutes. It was super simple. But of course, what I wanted to actually have it do is integrate with the media layer. At this point, I was just focused on Linux. I wanted it to integrate with the media layer on Linux. So when I changed the volume in the application, the Apple Music Electron application, I want that volume change to be reflected in the desktop volume settings. Right. And likewise, if I change the volume via MPRE, I want the application to change its volume as well. Now, it turned out this was a lot harder than Martin expected. So I did a bit of hunting around, and there are some other examples of how this is done. And also, Cider used to be open source back for version 1, but versions 2 and onwards are closed and proprietary, but the source code is still available for Cider. So I was able to go doing some archaeology there to see how they'd done it. And there's a couple of other efforts to have a go at this, which I got some clues from. So I wrote a little hook that binds to musickit.js, which is Apple's tool for rendering, you know, music stuff in their web-based clients. They've got like 6 events that you can hook into. So I hooked into that and wired it up over Dbus and MPRE and all the rest of it. And now I've got an application where I can skip tracks and pause and change the volume, and it all works in both directions. After a little bit of, you know, shenanigans, it all kind of works again. The difficult thing was I gave it to a couple of my friends to try out, and it didn't work for them at all after me having sat there for several hours listening to music, thinking, I'm king of the world, I've written an Apple Music desktop client. And it all came down to this DRM stuff. I couldn't just use regular Electron. There is a version of Electron published by Cast Labs, and they have a version of Electron that has Widevine baked into it. But most importantly, they have a mechanism by which you can apply for free, which I think is pretty amazing, apply for free for an account so you can sign your Electron builds to enable the fully verified Electron paths to do properly validated decryption. Now, on Linux, I did have to do this. I don't quite understand why, but it worked. But it meant on the Windows and Mac OS builds, it enabled lossless audio to work on those platforms. In fact, it didn't just enable lossless audio to work, it enabled them to work. And the side effect was you also had access to the higher bitrate audio feeds.
Nice.
So I ended up learning quite a lot about like how Widevine and DRM works and how it's kind of half working on Linux. And organizations like Netflix and Apple kind of give the Linux users a free pass to access the stuff because it doesn't have the full decryption chain enabled. But they go, okay, the user agent says Linux, we know they can't provide a fully verified thing. So we'll give them not the lossless audio, we'll give them like a slightly lower quality version of the audio that's available. So once I got all of that going, I was like, right, how do I make this like work like a real desktop application? So I added an app indicator. So that shows the cover art for each track, and you can skip forwards and backwards, and you can pause and do a bunch of other stuff. So all of the, in air quotes, UI for my application is mostly implemented through the app indicator rather than injecting foreign content into the Apple Music web view via the DOM, which is how some of these other clients have done it. Now, I did have to do a little bit of that because you do sometimes need to sort of, if you've clicked on a few artists in the UI, you do need a way to sort of navigate backwards out of there. So I did create a very simple hook, which is back, forwards and reload icons, which I inject into the navigation portion of the Apple Music thing. So it gives you the very basics to sort of navigate around and get about the thing. But overall, it's all working rather well. And because Electron, I was able to use Electron Builder to make packages for all of the things.
What you just said there about the desktop integration reminds me of, there used to be a feature in Unity, didn't there, where you could sort of hook into a web page or a website that you were visiting in your browser, and it could do that sort of thing, give you app indicators and give you menu entries. Rather than you injecting stuff into the web page, you could inject stuff into the desktop.
Yes, and I've sort of used some of those primitives here by hooking up this sort of JavaScript in the Electron browser piece and hooking it up into Dbus on the Linux side in order to create a bridge between the web version and the desktop version. And once I'd sort of got this far, I was like, well, there are reasons why I want this to work on Mac OS. And there's a couple of reasons for this. One is, if you're in like a corporate environment, as I am, if you have your Mac OS enrolled via MDM, you often don't get to sign in with your own Apple ID. You have to use the corporate account. So then the native Apple Music client can't authenticate with your own library because it's not your Apple ID. So because Sidra is an application that authenticates at the application layer, you can install it as like a third-party Apple Music client, and you can access your music library on your MDM-controlled device. Friend of the show, Yannick, was customer zero for this. His requirements for a Mac OS version of a third-party client were quite different, and that is that currently his daughter uses his Apple account to play lots of K-pop. So Yannick's music profile has been polluted with his daughter's music preferences as opposed to his own. So now what he does is he has Sidra installed, which his daughter uses using her own account, developing her own music profile and preferences, and no longer polluting his, you know, audio preferences in Apple Music.
Nice.
And then for giggles, I made a Windows version, which I have no Windows computer or means to test. So I farmed that off to Yannick as well. And he tells me it works. He made me a video to prove it works. So, yeah, I've published this on GitHub. There'll be a link in the show. But it's a fully formed Apple Music desktop client.
Are you going to sign the binaries for those people who are using a Mac and don't want to have to press silly buttons and type commands to make applications work?
So that question could be a whole segment that we could do in another podcast.
It was a yes or no question, actually. There was only two answers to that. Yes, I am going to sign it, or no, I'm not going to sign it.
So the short answer is I would like to do that. And I have figured out how much it would cost for me to do that. And it's about £475 a year. And this sparks a whole conversation where being an open source developer is not cost intensive in terms of your time. But in order to ship open source software to non-open source platforms is cost prohibitive if you want to do it properly. So this isn't a call to action, but I will explain what I've done. I've updated my GitHub sponsors to say, if you want signed Mac OS and Windows versions, sponsor here. And when it gets to this amount of money, I will buy the certificates and the subscriptions I need in order to sign these binaries properly. But right now, I'm not doing that. I'm telling you how to hack around it in the README.
Yeah, I know. That's what triggered the question. I saw you had a command line thing that enables it, but for those of us on Linux, we don't care about that kind of stuff.
No, it's all fun.
Download the RPM, the DMG, not DMG, the deb, or the app image. I noticed you've got in there as well. Is that a virtue of you doing Electron Builder?
Yeah. And at some point, I'll produce a snap as well. I've got one other feature I want to fully develop, which will affect what snap interfaces I need. So I want to add it's AirPlay casting. Exclusively to the Linux version, by the way. And once that's landed and I know what the interface requirements are, I'll make a snap as well.
A while back, we all spoke about our backups. And I went and looked at my backups a few months ago and I realized that everything was working fine, but they'd got quite big.
Doesn't that all happen to everyone's backups unless you go through and like delete and just throw it away?
Yes, but they got bigger than I expected in the time that I had expected. And the reason I noticed this is because one of the places that my backups sit is with a provider called iDrive, who I pay a small amount to for an object storage S3 compatible account, which is my off-site backup. And when I started, this was costing me about 20p a month. And I realized that this had grown to about £1 a month. Now, these aren't big numbers, but proportionally, that's quite a big growth. So I thought, I wonder what's caused this. I'll go and sort of have a look around and see if I can work out what's going on. Because yes, the data I have locally has grown a bit over time because I'm backing up things like photos and videos and stuff. But I didn't think it had grown an order of magnitude. This proved to be a bit trickier than I thought, because the way that I've got rClone set up for doing my backups, as I mentioned before, is I use their encryption layer in between my local backup and the object storage backend. So it basically, you point it at the encryption backend and you point the encryption backend at the storage backend. And what you end up with is encrypted file names and encrypted data in the object storage. I went and had a look there. And I thought, oh, I can't really tell what this is. What I'll have to do is mount this locally. Now, fortunately, with rClone, that's quite easy, because if you copy the config file locally, you then have access to your backups exactly as if you were on the server doing the backups. And you can run rClone GUI, which gives you the web front end. And from there, you can mount it. So if you mount the encrypted backup, it actually gives you then all of the plain text stuff as a mounted fuse volume. So I thought, I can run disk usage analyzer on this and it'll tell me what's big. And that got to 166,066 items and then crashed. Because of course, what this is actually doing is it's not reading a load of files off your disk. It's reading files via an object storage API, via an encryption API, one at a time, and taking a very long time to do it.
Is that impacting the price you're paying? You're now paying £1.20 or something because you pointed DUA at it? Or is the pricing free for reading and you're only paying for the...
Yeah,
the...
I think you're just paying for the storage, fortunately. Yeah, didn't think of that at the time. I also tried NCDU and it didn't crash, but it took forever and I had to give up. So what I was left with was basically going through the directory structure and looking at how many files were in each directory and how many files were in that path on object storage with encrypted file names, and mapping this together to try and work out what was there in the remote version that wasn't there in the local version that was taking up so much more space. And after quite a lot of grubbing around, I got somewhere. It turned out that Audio Bookshelf, which plays my audiobooks, which I have my audiobook library backed up, was also backing up metadata for each time I streamed something.
Ah.
And this was thousands of files. But of course, the metadata gets deleted after you stop doing a stream, but it was still getting backed up. So I went around looking at why they weren't being deleted from the backup. And it turns out, and I found quite an important line in the documentation for the rClone sync command, which says, files in the destination won't be deleted if there were any errors at any point. Which, of course, is a very good feature, because what you don't want is, oh, it couldn't read that file, therefore it doesn't exist in the backup anymore, I'm going to delete it. It basically just reports at the end, you know, there were these errors, therefore I'm deleting nothing.
That's unlike the rsync method that I use, where you can make the target similar to the source and say delete on the target as if it's been deleted on the source. And I guess that's normal, but if it can't read the file, surely you do want it to delete, but that's not by default, which is the same as rsync. It's not by default, right? That's
no. So the sync command in rclone will do the same thing. It says, you know, if something has been deleted, then delete it. But if it can see it there and it tries to read it and it gets an error, then it won't delete it.
Got it.
Because it can see it's still there, but something went wrong.
So this is a source file that existed at the point at which the backup started, but has been removed by the point at which the backup finishes. So it leaves the backup in place, even though the transient file on the client end has gone away.
No, it wasn't quite that. What it turned out was that some of the directories that were being included in the backup, because I have quite a broad sort of target for the backup, basically the directory that all of the Docker containers put their data in on the host, some of them had permissions which the process running the backup couldn't read. And that was, I think, probably because of containers writing things as root or something like that. So I found these permission errors in the log and I realized, oh, actually, none of that is stuff I need to back up. So all I did was add an exclude rule. I ran it again and it deleted from the 300,000 objects that it was backing up, it deleted about 230,000 of them.
Wow.
Wowzers.
And reduced my backup size considerably.
So what are you going to do with your extra 80p a month?
Well, this is the thing. You see, because I have versioning turned on, I don't do any versioning of backups locally, but what I do is I have versioning turned on in my object storage. So when something does get deleted, it actually gets kept for 3 months. So if I realize, you know, oh no, something shouldn't have gone, I can actually recover it. And then after 3 months, it gets expired by lifecycle policies. So I've been waiting for this change to come into effect. And it's now been about 3 months. And I went looking, I was like, oh no, there's still quite a lot of data in there. And what's happening is, now my data is starting to grow more and more. And I think I need to go through and see things like, you know, when every single photo and video gets uploaded from my phone, I probably don't actually need all of those forever. And Image, which is my photo management application, that creates databases of thumbnails. And that is a lot of files and that all gets backed up. But if I lost the thumbnail database, I can regenerate that. So I probably don't need to be backing that up. So I think what I need to do, now that I've got my backups working and I know they're reliable and I know I can get data back, I need to think about what of this data do I actually need going forwards and tidy it all up a bit.
Yes, I ask myself that question regularly and the answer is all of it, all of it, all of the time, everywhere.